You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia on the 2nd of June 2010. I'm your host, Herewood Fenton. Tonight we've got a lead story focusing on the events in the Eastern Mediterranean with a number of ships in the flotilla being intercepted by Israel, and a larger ship, of course, being attacked, and a number of people being killed. I've lined up an interview for later tonight with Michael Shake, who came on the show a couple of months ago to talk about the Palestinian situation. He's a spokesman for an Australian-Palestinian advocacy group here based in Melbourne. So he'll be coming on a bit later to explain what's going on and hopefully clarify some of the confusion over the events that actually occurred on that day, with reports that some of the people on the ship actually were attacking the soldiers, and we've seen footage of that. And, of course, the massive, you know, brutal reaction was to kill up to 20 of the people on the boat. And they've all now been arrested and deported to Israel, where they're currently being held. And so we can't actually find out from those witnesses what happened. We're stuck with the information that we've got so far that came out as the attack was taking place, which came out on satellite television and a number of reports before the Israelis were able to jam all the signals. And we haven't even heard from Paul McGough yet, as far as I know. He's the Australian journalist, leading Middle East correspondent for Fairfax, who was on the ship. So there's a lot of unknowns at the moment about what actually happened there. So that's coming up in about 25 minutes. Now, before we get into that story, we're going to run through some of the main stories that have been building up over the last couple of weeks. We haven't done a show for almost 2 weeks, unfortunately. Too many things to do, and I'd always love to be able to do more shows, but I've got a few other responsibilities I have to take care of. And welcoming to the show, the renowned Joshua Jackson, who is going to be joining us for the rest of the evening. Welcome, Josh.
Well, renowned, I'm not sure what for, but I'm renowned for something or other.
Well, you're
making good graphics.
Your reputation precedes you, sir. Yes, indeed. You're a great graphic artist and important member of the mainstream media. But we won't go into too many details there. But we know that you. In fact, both of us have a foot in the mainstream media, but that's
we sure do.
That's a story for another day.
Yeah. We try to inject the truth into the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And
if anyone out there listening to the show ever wants to interview me, go right ahead. I'm happy to be interviewed. You know, get me on your show.
Yeah, you know? Start a show, folks.
Yeah, start a show. Get me and Josh on your show and ask us questions.
Yeah, that's right.
Give us the third degree.
So what's on the show today?
Okay, well, as I mentioned earlier, we've got Michael Shake coming on in about 20 minutes to give us complete up-to-date information about what is happening with the flotilla, the remnants of which are still heading towards Gaza, I believe. And many of them who were captured are now in Israel. They've been put into detention in Israel, including Paul McGough, the journalist, because we haven't heard from him yet. So the top journalist from Fairfax is, as I must assume, still in the custody of Israel. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I've been scanning the news stories today. I haven't seen him pop up. So that's pretty unusual. I mean, normally the press are given a fairly free, you know. They don't normally regard the press as being kind of the enemy.
No.
Especially, you know, from a friendly country, you know. like Australia. Mm. So that's a bit disturbing, I must say. So look, apart from that, look, we've got a whole lot of stories because we haven't done a show for almost 2 weeks. And
Yeah, I'm sorry for that, folks. We had a bit of a break. You know, we're only human.
Yeah, we are. We are. We have our flaws.
We do this all for free.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We still don't charge access, and we don't even beg for donations. Mainly because I haven't managed to, you know, put the energy into setting all that up. It'll happen soon. I mean, we will be asking for donations. The time will come. Your time to give will come.
Bandwidth is slowly building up as every show stays online as an archive.
That's right. And, that's
all that
right.
Stuff costs money, which we're paying for with our own means and ways.
Well, of course, the price of success will be that we actually have to pay more. If we suddenly have a story that goes mega, you know, our servers will crash.
Which I think we will in the next few months. We've got some amazing stuff lined up.
I think it's quite likely that could happen, especially with this, you know, the visit of Niels Harrit, the professor from Denmark. I feel that's pretty, you know, earth-shaking, actually, in my own way. But anyway, without further ado, let's get into some news stories for tonight. So we've got a Turkish Navy to back next convoy following Gaza flotilla. Now, this is quite an alarming development because it may not transpire as predicted here, but it says here that Israel is facing another potentially explosive confrontation at sea as pro-Palestinian activists sent two more boats to challenge its blockade of the Gaza Strip. Turkey, one of Israel's closest Muslim allies until Monday's clash, left several of its citizens dead, was last night reported to be considering sending a naval escort for the boats. Now, if that happens, that's tantamount to war. So, I don't know whether to think it's good or bad that happens. It's really hard to say. I mean, but the tension here is building, you know, and it's really now it's between nation states. So we'll get more on that. Yeah, we'll get more on that later on in the show. Let's just move to some other news. We've got, I'm just a little bit slack here reading through this. Former BBC reporter Alan Hart reveals Mossad involved in 9/11 on Alex Jones TV. I highly recommend this interview with Alex Jones. It's one of the best I've seen on Alex Jones. And it's one of the few that I would actually recommend giving out to people. If you know what I mean.
It's funny with Alex. He's a bit too full on.
He's a bit blustery. That's the problem. That's why you can't always recommend him. But if you were to sort of, you know, edit out some, actually that particular interview was pretty good. You know, I mean, you could give that to your mum, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, that's the measure, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. Could you give it to your mum?
Is this too offensive for your mum?
And I think if you just put up with Alex's bluster, and you listen to the information, listen to what Alan Hart has to say, it's a very revealing interview because it really does cut to the quick. It gets right into all the topics.
Alan Hart, for those that don't know, is a renowned BBC journalist. He's been around since the '60s. He exposed a lot of stuff during the Vietnam War. He also has great friends with
with Golda Meir, the founder of Israel, and he was friends with Yasser Arafat.
So both sides of the story, he's great friends with, and he's recently retired from the BBC.
Yeah, he's in his 80s,
and has strongly come out saying, "Yeah, 9/11 was an inside job. It absolutely was." It wasn't just one group. It wasn't like, ooh, this is them, let's blame them. You know, he's saying in the interview that it most probably started off as an all-Muslim thing, and then, of course, Mossad got hold of wind of it, and the neocons got wind of it and decided to use it towards their goals, and I tend to agree with that. What about you, Herwood?
Look, we don't know. It's a fine theory. I think what we do know is that historically, all so-called terror groups are heavily infiltrated, to the point where it's hard to differentiate between is it really a terror group or is it a controlled opposition group that is used, and this is the policy of the CIA. I mean, it's declassified that they
Australia
were doing
does
that.
It. Like last year? It was all over the news. Some terrorist group got busted because they were going to make a bomb and exploded. Then it comes out, and it was totally open that it had been totally infiltrated by the Federal Police of Australia, the Australian Federal Police, and they had been teaching these total no-hopers how to make bombs. When they didn't have a clue. I mean, these guys are these ridiculous wannabe terrorists are so stupid. They've got no resources, no nothing. They're all talk.
It's very
then they
common.
Get infiltrated by these police. They go out, they spend months with them, teaching them how to do everything. And then they go, aha, busted.
Yeah. And this is a long history of this. It's you can watch online, you can watch the Gladio, Operation Gladio. It goes back through the history of Western Europe since the end of World War II. And this was the policy to create fake opposition groups that ultimately became, that they started off being fascist groups, then they were converted into being communist groups, and then they were actually primed to commit terrorist acts. And they did it in Italy, they did it in Germany, the Bader-Meinhof were connected to it, the Red Brigades in Italy, and they called this the strategy of tension. The Italian government was involved in it. The CIA initiated it starting from the end of the Second World War. This technique, it's well established. Anyway.
Yeah, and funnily enough, it's illegal in a lot of ways. So, you know, the police aren't allowed to give someone a whole heap of drugs, tell them to sell them, and then bust them for being drug dealers.
Well, I mean, that occurs as well.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Of course it does.
Yeah,
but it's called entrapment, and yeah. it's not really allowed, right? But
yeah,
for some reason, it always happens.
Yeah, you're funny you should mention that, Josh, because there's been quite a few stories come out. I remember a fairly recent one. There was like kilos of cocaine being sold as part of a so-called sting operation, but that they went through massive amounts of this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how many kilos of cocaine do you need for a sting operation?
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, we have to keep our eye on that story. Now, another one I want to cover briefly here, really important one. Rebel scientists force the Royal Society to accept climate change skepticism. Now, the Royal Society, if you don't know what it is, it's the most prestigious scientific organization in the world. It goes back hundreds of years.
Mm.
The Royal Society was what Charles Darwin presented his theory of evolution to. It is the most august and respected scientific institution. And it says here, Britain's premier scientific institution is being forced to review its statements on climate change after a rebellion by members who question mankind's contribution to rising temperatures. The Royal Society has apportioned a panel to rewrite the 350-year-old institution's official position on global warming. It will publish a new guide to the science of climate change this summer. The Society has been accused by 43 of its fellows of refusing to accept dissenting views on climate change and exaggerating the degree of certainty that man-made emissions are the main cause.
Mm.
So, look, this scandal over the misrepresentation of science just has no end. I mean, it's an outrage. It's a crime against humanity to corrupt science in the way that has been done. And I'll just get out there and say it. The debate. There is a debate. I do accept that there is a debate about climate change, but there's, to me, no debate that there are people out there who've completely lied and corrupted and been driven by monetary political interests.
Yeah, well, it all comes down to this sort of urgency that people feel. oh, we don't have time to even think right now. We don't have time to keep arguing the thing, the concept. We have to just have action.
Correct.
And, you know, for a lot of times you think, well, you know, that's a good argument. You know, we have to, we just have to do it. We just have to tax the world by a global banking elite using the IMF infrastructure to basically tax the heck out of everyone. Now, you know, I really have to warn everybody that we need to step back and we need to really look at the whole scientific procedure to say, no, this is wrong. It's wrong just to say, no, it's too late. We got to go. Sure, we got to look at this topic seriously because the claims that are being made are full on. But at the same time, the answers that are being put forward are full on. So to say, oh, the problem is so full on, we got to just do something. And here's a mega full on answer that's just hardcore, like basically the crushing of free market capitalism, the destruction of free enterprise, the mass taxing of the global population, plus the mass policing of the taxation system and the infrastructure put in place. So there's a lot to lose as well. So do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. There's a hell of a lot to lose. Yeah.
Mm.
There's a great article. I'm just trying to load here. No, it's not going to load for me. Oh, hang on. It's coming. I just want to read something here. It's an editorial piece that was published in The Australian. And the title of the article is The True Nature of Skeptics. Unafraid questioning minds are central to the pursuit of truth and democracy. At Easter, the official Greenpeace website carried a blog written by Jean Hashimi, communications director of its affiliate in India. Hashimi pointed his finger at skeptics who fueled spurious debates around false solutions and concluded with the not too subtle threat, "We know who you are, we know where you live, we know where you work, and we be many but you be few." Welcome to a world where the term skeptic has acquired a meaning usually associated with a Dark Age heresy. Fearing a backlash to a statement that most normal readers would interpret as an incitement to violence, Greenpeace pulled the blog from its site. It defensively justified its act of self-censorship on the ground that it was very easy to misconstrue the statement. Now, this article is really worth a read because he gets into the question of what is skepticism, the true nature of skepticism, and he refers back to the ancient Greeks. If I can just see it here.
Yeah, well, folks, you know, I used to, when growing up, skeptics used to absolutely do my head in as well, right? Because they would just be skeptical of everything. You know, you'd say, oh, but what about ghosts? Nah, no such thing. And you say, well, look at the amazing like things, stories and stuff that comes up. But as I started to delve into science and truly understand the notion of skepticism, it comes down to having reproducible proof and following quite old methods that we've developed as a humanity over the years to get to truth. Now, even if something is a scientific truth, there can still be skepticism because new ways of developing new experiments come along.
Can I just interject? I think the word truth is not really appropriate for science.
Mm.
Science actually doesn't deal with truth per se. Science only deals with generalizations, which become theories, which will, you know, withstand observation. So, like the theory of gravity. Now, it could turn out that the theory of gravity is wrong. It could be disproved.
It's actually turning out right now. There's been a lot of people are saying that gravity is actually wrong.
Yeah, and Einstein Einstein discovered that Newton's version of it was incorrect. because gravity is actually affected by
time, space.
Yeah, by space time, and so you see, science doesn't have dogmatic belief systems. Now, I'll just quickly read here.
Well, it does, but usually down to ego.
Yeah, indeed. I'll just read here quickly. Skepticism today, as in the past, has a bad name because for the dogmatic believer, any sign of doubt, hesitation, uncertainty, questioning, and even indifference is interpreted as disbelief. In recent centuries, disbelief was interpreted as synonymous with atheism, and the skeptic was portrayed as a moral outcast. A wide range of attitudes, denial, unbelief, questioning, were often associated with the morally corrupt, and that is why the term skeptic possessed a highly charged pejorative connotation. In fact, it was the act of questioning the received wisdom that was perceived as the real heresy by the moral crusaders targeting skepticism. The 15th century Witch Hunters Manual claimed that those who denied the existence of witches were no less guilty of heresy than the active practitioners of witchcraft.
Yeah.
And this is the irrational, you know, madness of this type of thinking. You see, if you denied that witches exist, you become a witch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, see, that's very similar to the climate change. If you deny that man-made climate change is real, you are part of the evil conspiracy that is creating climate change through in other words, they project that you are employed secretly by the oil companies and that you're part of the evil empire creating the CO2.
No, that's right. I mean, we were at the massive demonstration for everybody for government to do something about tax that was held last year, and I had about four or five people yelling at me, who's paying you? Who are you? Who's employing you? Like I'm, you know, employed by some massive oil, you know, company. And the fact of the matter is, it's actually the other way around, but we won't go into that.
Indeed. I mean, it's kind of a superstition. It's like a religious, theological kind of way of thinking.
Yeah, a lot of the oil companies are actually paying to have the carbon credits put in place because it's a giant tax write-off. It's a giant scam because they get thousands of millions and millions of dollars, trillions even, I could imagine it would over years, to basically free from the taxpayer to pay for carbon credits because the government have put in place rules and of alleviating the problem of taking on carbon Absolutely. Credit infrastructure.
We're going to have to end it there. We've got Michael Shake coming on shortly. We're going to have a little short break, and then we'll be back with the Gaza-Israel question. Stand by. Okay, well, we've had a delay there getting Michael on the line, so we just want to continue with a few other stories. There's a story that I picked up on actually by direct experiment. I'm quite a fan of Bob Dylan. I've been listening to his
As
music.
As if our listeners didn't know.
Well,
the amount of Bob we air on this show.
Yeah, I kind of got interested in Bob after being involved in the truth movement. I wasn't before that, and it was kind of just a combination of things, but I realized that this guy was really quite an amazing genius, and I sort of came to that late. I mean, most people already knew that, but anyway, we won't get into that. But what was interesting was that there was so much great material on YouTube of his early performances, because a lot of stuff was actually filmed that was done in the early mid-60s. And it's all gone. It's all gone.
How long did it take? About, you know, 24, 48 hours?
Well, they've been deleting it progressively. There seems to have been a sudden purge, though, because I noticed last week, and everything I tried to search for just didn't come up with anything. And I tried to find out why, and I found this one article here, The Incredible Shrinking World of Bob Dylan. Sony Music and Bob Dylan are pushing Bob Dylan fan videos off YouTube, as we predicted last fall. This is from NJN Network. When the day of the Locust video was removed from our story, Bob Dylan original art and prints, it was just another Dylan video removed by YouTube. A search for Bob Dylan on YouTube produced 65,000 videos, down from more than 110,000 in September. For the most part, the Bob Dylan videos remaining are on official channels like Bob Dylan TV. And what I can tell you about that is most of them won't play in Australia. You try to play them and they'll say, oh, it's not available for your region, which is just a total slap in the face, you know.
Yeah. Now, why we bring this up is because culturally it's this sort of cultural police state almost. I mean, first of all, an artist is definitely allowed to make money from their work. I don't disagree with that. The problem here is that we have a whole lot of conversation and people talking about these videos. The videos aren't, the songs aren't really even that important here. It's the cultural exchange between people from all around the world having conversations all of a sudden gone.
Yeah, that's a really important part of it. But of course, it's also quite important when you've got performances that aren't actually available in any other form. I mean, these were like bootleg recordings, some of which are just really amazing recordings, and they're not on the albums that you can actually buy. So, but they've been bootlegged for years, you know, and you can get those bootleg discs if you really hunt around. But I've actually had trouble even finding those. I tried to see if I could download them, and I couldn't find the torrents for them either. So, it's just an incredible. It makes us all poorer by doing it. It will financially make Bob Dylan poorer because people won't even know about him because, you know, he's a relic. And the only thing that keeps his music alive is actually stuff like YouTube. It's stuff on the internet.
Yeah. You know, the only thing that kills an artist faster than not actually selling anything is obscurity.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that is definitely what's going to happen. I mean, it's already happening. And I think, you know, the problem here, Herod, is that there is no other options. Like when Napster came along, there was no options for people. People wanted to buy MP3s online. They wanted them, and they wanted them cheap because there wasn't any disc, there wasn't any artwork, but they wanted to listen to a song. Now, Napster came along with this sharing concept where you stick an MP3, you share your whole folder of MP3s, and all of a sudden everyone can see your MP3s and download it. And then when millions of people are doing this, all of a sudden every piece of music ever created was online.
Yeah.
Now, and then the record industry went psycho.
Yeah.
You know, they literally went around like just suing everyone they could possibly see moving, you know. So what happened is they started becoming really nasty, and they're still very nasty. I mean, the content industry is pretty much the ones predominantly behind the Australian content, the Australian internet filter, along with big government and right-wing conservative hardcore Christian lobbies. But what we're seeing is...
Well, the film and television industry, if I could just interject, they want to bring in a different type of internet censorship. They want to stop people from being able to download copyrighted material. So it's actually another layer of effective censorship that they want to apply, which is actually quite draconian. It's quite extreme. They actually want to be able to, you know, enforce that ISPs have to cut people's internet access off. And this is what they tried to do in Europe, and it was kicked. You know,
see, what happened, though, right, is that the record industry were that stupid and big and old and, no, I'm just going to sue everyone. Because they'd rather use violence by going around using the courts and police to arrest people if they don't pay these massive exorbitant fines. Some people were wanting them to pay, you know, over $2-3 million for downloading a couple of songs. And so... instead of actually thinking and using their creativity like you have to in a free market to try and overcome new competition, instead they would just use the state. Now, what happened? Well, Mac came along, Steve Jobs came along and said, hey, there's a, you know, as a creative entrepreneur, and said, well, there's a big vacuum here. There's a massive market. people want to download stuff legally, but there's no option for them. Yeah. So they have to go online, risk arrest, risk $1 million fines, risk losing their house, risk, you know, all this stuff for downloading some songs. So I'll create the iStore. So they created iTunes, and all of a sudden, multi-million-dollar iTunes is now the biggest retailer of music online and off.
They made a lot of money out of it. Yeah,
they have literally billions of dollars pouring through those doors every, you know, whatever. It's just so amazingly rich. Now, what is the problem here? Well, if people want to upload something to YouTube, there's a problem. There's a gap in the market. So, oh, let's just destroy everything. Let's just tear it all down. Well, where are the options for people?
It's ridiculous. It's an opportunity. It's not a threat. You know, they could be putting ads on those YouTube pages that you could, because a lot of people don't know how to download things from YouTube. You can do it if you have all the right add-ons and stuff, right? But then you get an FLV file and, you know, that's not an MP3 file and you can't play it in your media player. And, you know, it's actually quite hard for a lot of people who aren't geeks to actually do all this stuff. Now, if they just put a service on YouTube and they could advertise it like crazy, that if do you like this video, this bootleg video you're watching, well, you can get, you know, a crisp, you know, version of it with all of the related, you know, songs from that same album or performance by paying $5.
Yeah.
And they would make a fortune because the ones I'm talking about, but Bob Dylan, they had millions and millions of hits. Some of them had millions and millions of views, right?
But see, this goes even further, right? So now if we have something like that, now let's take it to the fact that you just want to make a video of your dog jumping around the backyard and you decide to put a song in the background. That video will be taken down.
Oh, yeah. Although quite often what they do is they disable the soundtrack.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. I had not even the whole song. I had a little clip behind some little sketch, little comedy sketch I did, and they just disabled the music, and I got this email saying, your track has been disabled. This is copyright infringement. Now, instead of using their creativity and saying, well, hang on, we need some sort of new licensing agreement here. We need to say, look, if this is not for commercial purpose, then use it as long as you credit the artist.
Absolutely.
Now, because then you're creating a culture, you're using art as it should be used, as a cultural, something to make cultural more.
But also, Josh, I'd like to emphasize that instead of thinking punitively, instead of always thinking, how do we punish, think positively, how do we make the most of this? Because when they just want to think, how are we going to punish people? But the example I said before, there's no punishment at all. It's just that if there's bootleg material on there, you provide a service which is going to compete with the bootleg material for a small amount of money, but you've got millions of potential buyers.
Yeah.
So you're going to actually exploit an opportunity. And no one needs to be punished at all. There doesn't need to be anything about copyright violation, any kind of enforcement of you've got to do this or you've got to do that. You just provide a service, which is a monetized thing that people can pay that little bit extra and get a guaranteed downloadable thing, you know, that will work. Yeah.
And honestly, folks, it doesn't take much brains. You know, I mean, we this is literally off the top of our head. I mean, if we had a little research department who could come up with the best way of monetizing some of these concepts, I mean, it's just so obvious. But, you know, the thing is, the concept of putting a music track behind something for artistic purpose, if you're not going to make any money from it, if it is purely for an artistic purpose to stick something online and, you know, I'm going to stick a video of my dog and it's going to be really funny and I'm hoping for as many hits as I can, but I'm not going to make any money. The only pure enjoyment I get is that people are watching it. Now, if people get to hear a soundtrack behind that, what's that doing? Well, it's advertising the track. And that should be, literally, it should be a given that you should be, there should be a license option. Now, artists should be able to opt out of the licensing option and should say, well, we don't even want that. Well, that's their choice. But at least give us some options and saying, hey, all of these people from Sony BMG and all the, these artists have chosen, well, we're going to go under this, so you're allowed to use it for this, but not for commercial purpose. And it, and to go on top of that, there should be an option to say, hey, I want to use this for commercial options. How do I pay? Because right now, if I'm a video maker and I want to use it, it takes so long, it's almost impossible to try and find a cheap way to use a track in your music in something that you're using for a commercial purpose. Yeah, I mean, you have to go through so many channels.
It's getting harder and harder, isn't it?
So, you know, it would be really nice if YouTube or other companies like that would give the choice for the consumer, who is not only the consumer, it's the wrong word now, consumer, because you're actually the creator on concepts like YouTube, to give the creator the option of saying, hey, well, I want to use a music track, I'll pay, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or $5 or $100, I don't know what the market price is, but at least if the option is there, then people can use it and monetize it, and the companies can monetize it. But instead, no, let's just sue everyone. I mean, it's absurd.
It is. Look, on that note, let's play a track. One of the few tracks I can find here of a live performance of Bob Dylan.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove see before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years must a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times must a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Times must a man look up before he can really see the sky? Yes, and how many years must one man have before he can hear a people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows too many people have died? My friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception, and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, welcome back to the show. Now, tonight, our main story of tonight, of course, is the massacre that happened on the high seas with the flotilla that has been heading to Gaza. Quite a number of ships involved in it and quite a lot of people involved. And the loss of life is, you know, at least 20 or 19 or so from what I've heard. And there's been some questions raised about what actually happened. Most of the people are still in custody, as I understand it. And we're sort of really scratching our heads to figure out what really took place. And I've asked Michael Sheikh to come back on the show tonight. We did a great interview a couple of months back about Gaza, and Michael very nicely agreed to come back on the show. He's very busy. He's got a lot to deal with, because Michael runs an important Palestinian group, Australians for Palestine, here in Australia. So, Michael, thanks for coming on the show on such short notice.
You're welcome. Just a correction, I don't run Australians for Palestine. I work for Australians for
Palestine. Sorry about that. Yeah, that sounds a bit over the top. Look, thanks for that. And, Michael... Could we possibly start off with just looking at this question of the claims that Israel is making about the violence? I know there's a lot to talk about, but this one is actually going to be potentially a PR problem for the pro-Palestinian movement. What have you got? Do you have any information that we don't have about that?
No, I'm afraid I don't. All I can tell you is what we all know, and that's that the activists who were involved, you know, on the boats have not been allowed by Israel to give their account of the story. So the only version we've got is the Israeli account. We know that the boats were in international waters when they were boarded by Israeli commandos. We know that the ships were of no conceivable threat to Israel, not even Israel's claim that they were smuggling weapons or anything like that on board. And we know that it was a humanitarian mission that they were on, that at no point did they enter Gaza's waters, and that only a couple of weeks ago, the head of the United Nations in Gaza called upon the international community to defy Israel's blockade of Gaza, the Gaza Strip, to bring humanitarian aid in by sea because Israel wasn't allowing sufficient amounts into the Gaza Strip. That's what we know as a fact. Anything else at this stage is either speculation or Israeli propaganda. And, you know, to give Israel credit, they've done a fairly effective job at media management over the last couple of days, because what they're counting on is for the heat to go out of the story. So yes, when the true story comes out about what happened, the media circus will have moved on.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? And they obviously were quite careful to video that when the soldiers were coming down on the ship there, that they've got the video of that. And of course, it doesn't look too good. The soldiers are being attacked, but I understand there have been also claims. There was some video that did get out before the signals were jammed from, I think it was Press TV in Iran, that was saying that the ship was being fired on before the soldiers even boarded the ship. That's one claim I've heard.
Yes, I've heard that claim as well. I mean, what's happened? The Ban Ki-moon and a lot of other world leaders have called for an independent United Nations investigation, and I think that's probably the only way we're going to get involved in this. Regrettably, the Rudd government's called upon Israel to launch an investigation of its own actions, you know, regarding the flotilla. And given, you know, Israel's record of cover-ups and that, you know, they're the criminal party in this case, you know, that would be a joke, essentially. So, like I said, we don't know what really happened. But, you know, one way would be to have an independent international investigation as to what happened on the boats. The other point I'd just like to make issue with, you know, Israel's using this footage, which seems to show, you know, its soldiers being attacked by, you know, the passengers on board, to say, well, look, that the flotilla were the aggressors and they attacked their soldiers. That the flotilla was of no threat to Israel whatsoever. And, you know, it was Israeli armed commandos with live ammunition that boarded the boat. Now,
correct,
if a couple of them did get roughed up by, you know, some of the passengers, it certainly wasn't aggression. It was the Israeli commandos who boarded the boat in international waters.
Which, of course, is an international crime in itself, isn't it? I mean,
Indeed. Yeah. And, you know, I think it really bears repeating that, you know, what we were dealing, you know, the big story here and, you know, the whole purpose of the mission was what's happening in the Gaza Strip, not what actually happened on the boats. Last year, according to the United Nations and Amnesty International, Israel launched an assault on the Gaza Strip that lasted for 22 days, in which the Israeli army systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure, including residential houses, wells, water purification plants, sewage treatment plants. They killed tens of thousands of head of livestock, razed, vast tracts of farmland and orchards, and destroyed or damaged 600 to 700 factories. That's according to Amnesty International's figures. And as a result of this and the blockade, there's been a total collapse of Gaza's economy. More than three-quarters of the population is now reliant on international food aid, and Israel's not even allowing enough food aid or basic medical equipment into the Gaza Strip to meet its needs, let alone luxury items which we take for granted, such as clothing, light bulbs, kitchen utensils, and other day-to-day necessities which have to be smuggled in from Egypt at very inflated prices. And it was as a result of that John Ging called upon the international community to break the blockade. The international community, as is usually the case with Israel, totally ignored this request. So, the feeling was that, when the world leaders fail to do the right thing and stand up for justice, it's up to ordinary people to do their bit to, help the victims of injustice. And that was the whole idea behind the Free Gaza campaign. Mm. I'll just make that point because, Israel's only kind of focusing on what happened on the decks of one of the ships. And we've always said that the real story is a silent catastrophe in Gaza, which every now and then makes it onto the news. But for the rest of the time, there's, this silent, tragedy unfolding.
Just want to read here. I've got a page up from the BBC. Goods allowed into Gaza. It seems very arbitrary what they allow in. Canned meat and tuna, but not canned fruit. Mineral water, but not fruit juice. Sesame paste, but not jam. Tea and coffee, but not chocolate.
So, how can you say that chocolate and jam have any security justification for an item that's not allowed in? And that's what all of the NGOs working in the Gaza Strip, whether Israeli or international, have said the same thing. Israel's blockade has nothing to do with Hamas. It's about punishing the people of Gaza for their support of Hamas and trying to make them turn against Hamas by, tightening the screws upon them. For 4 years now, you got to remember, it didn't even start with the takeover of Hamas of the Gaza Strip in 2007. It started at the beginning of 2006 when the Israeli government spokesman said what they were doing was giving the Palestinians an appointment with a dietitian. And what that meant is, as he put it, they'll get a lot thinner, but they wouldn't die in the numbers needed to provoke an international crisis.
So it really is about reducing their caloric intake. That is really what they're doing.
Well, that was the official reason given in 2006, after Hamas won the Palestinian elections. And if you want to look it up on the internet, it was an advisor to the prime minister called Dov Weisglass. He represented the government, and he briefed the Israeli media, and he said, we're making them an appointment with a dietitian. They'll get a lot thinner, but they won't die in the numbers needed to cause a humanitarian, a media event, essentially. But in the meantime, things like school books and stationery aren't getting in. And obviously since 2006, they've really turned the screws a lot tighter, because not only have they destroyed, its industrial capacity, just to make ordinary household goods, but they've cut off raw materials. So even those factories that have survived are idling, and, prevented the ordinary goods from entering the Gaza Strip. So the people there are doing it very hard.
Michael, this is something that I always come up against is, if I even mention the catastrophes happening over there, I get answers like, let them fight it out. That'll never end. It's never going to change. It's always like that. And it just makes me feel so sad that there's this despicable war and aggression happening, and everyone's just like, yeah, that's just always been there.
Yeah, that's one of the unfortunate things about Israel. I mean, there are some people who are pro-Palestinian, and there's others who are pro-Israel for various reasons. But my view is at least half of the population are laboring under the idea that this is an ancient, thousand-year-old conflict. And Jews and Arabs, you know, they just naturally hate each other for, you know, primordial reasons. And that's why all the peace processes have failed. And that's why international intervention, you know, will never make things better. So you might as well just leave it so that they can go on and kill each other. Now, I mean, this is an extremely inaccurate point of view. You know, the conflict started with, you know, the Zionist ideology that, you know, the Jews of Europe had a right to take over someone else's country to establish a Jewish state there. And that was, you know, it's a very recent to this antipathy between Israelis and Palestinians in historical terms, you know, less than 100 years old, really. But, you know, that kind of narrative, you know, it feeds right back in to kind of like a false neutrality where you just bow out and let the powerful have their way with, you know, a defenseless and unarmed population that cannot protect themselves, such as in the Gaza Strip.
And the other thing I always get is, you know, if you start even saying the word Zionism or you sort of you say something against the Israel, all of a sudden, you know, you're a racist. And, I mean, I'm the furthest from a racist I can imagine. I think we're all created equal. But it's the violence that I can't understand, the violence right now. And for them just to sort of throw this meme around it or this sort of thing, you're anti-Semitic or...
I suppose you've got to be tough-skinned. I remember the first time I was called that, I was a bit shocked. But I suppose you toughen up with time. And it's a last defense. In other words, if you talk about Palestinian rights and express concern about, you know, according to the United Nations now, you know, the water in Gaza is so polluted because, you know, all the surface water in the Strip has been diverted away from it. So they're only reliant on the coastal aquifer, which can't recharge properly, so it's below sea level. Plus, it's been contaminated with sewage because they've destroyed a sewage plant, so that the sewage is just seeping through the sand into the water table. But if you talk too much about the fact that, you know, the number one killer of children in Gaza today is diarrhea because they're drinking contaminated water, if you talk about that too much, the last card they can come back with you at is that, you know, you don't really care about the Palestinians. Now, this has nothing to do with human rights. You must have a perverse motive, and that is that you've got some irrational hatred of Jewish people. And it is an insult to anyone's intelligence apart from anything else. It's like saying that you were anti-white if you were, you know, were concerned about the welfare of black people under apartheid in South Africa or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'd just like to point out, Michael, since I've been involved in a lot of controversial information over the past few years, I've actually come up against quite a few people who are extremely racist and do have, you know, quite toxic views about Jewish people. And I always say to them that I totally reject that type of thinking. And I try to get them to, and I get attacked then. They call me a Zionist because I don't support the extreme hostile, you know, Jewish conspiracy beliefs. So there's a variety of problems in our society with people who've got extreme views. But what I say to the people who say that is, it's completely wrong and inaccurate to accuse the Jewish people as being the problem when it's clearly the nation state of Israel. It's clearly a political criminal enterprise that's government and politics, and it doesn't really have anything to do with your ethnicity or your religion.
Yes, I agree with that. You know, I have never made the claim that Israel somehow represents the natural aspirations of the Jewish people or that it's an intrinsically Jewish state. That's what the Zionists say.
Indeed.
Unfortunately, if you keep repeating a lie like that enough, eventually people do come to believe you. And, you know, when, unfortunately, Jews in places like Melbourne and Sydney cheer on atrocities committed by the Israeli state, that lends credence as well to the fact that Israel is not just a nasty, vicious, you know, racist state, but actually does represent Jews as a whole. And I reckon, you know, either side that kind of makes that claim has been very responsible as well as inaccurate.
But there are...
So, you know, they feed right into that, unfortunately. I would never say that. But Zionists, unfortunately, do say that Israel does represent the Jewish people in its, you know, ideology and actions.
Yeah, I think what the world would really help is for a Jewish movement to say we want an end to this. Mm-hmm. And I think there already is a lot of this sort of action happening, but it's not big enough.
Yeah, it's happening. I mean, a lot of, you know, progressive Jews have written a lot of very good books and, you know, are very active in fighting against Zionism and, you know, on behalf of the Palestinians. A lot of the great anti-Zionist thinkers are actually Jewish. You know, I mean, in Australia, obviously, we've got people like Peter Slezak and Anthony Lowenstein. In the United States, for instance, it's a lot stronger. You know, you go to New York and places like that, and a lot of the Palestinian solidarity groups are, you know, the Jews are a substantial minority there. And I think it's changing here. A lot of younger Jewish people, they don't think there's another Holocaust around the corner. They have non-Jewish friends, and they can't understand why Israel's doing what it's doing. And hopefully they'll increasingly feel alienated, feel more confident asking questions, and eventually stand up, you know, against Israel with the Palestinians and say, look, you're not doing this in my name.
What is the end game of the Israeli state? What do they want? I mean, do they just want to wipe that whole region out and take over the whole lot? And what's the end game of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian extremists?
Okay, I'm not sure that Israel has an end game. It's got a priority, and that is to maintain its sovereignty over the whole of historic Palestine, or what they call the land of Israel, you know, between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And in the meantime, you know, they've just got a lot of fixes for that, whether it's kind of, you know, sealing off Gaza so that it can never kind of gain any freedom or independence, or building settlements throughout the West Bank so that any future Palestinian state there is no more than a collection of reservations, and Israel maintains effective, you know, sovereignty throughout the West Bank. That's an overwhelming national priority. Now, how it will deal with that over the longer term, I think, is more or less on a hand-to-mouth basis. The ultimate hope, I think, is that life will become so tough for the Palestinians that they'll just leave. But I don't see that happening somehow. As for the end game of the Palestinian extremists, I'm not sure which Palestinian extremists you mean, because it's such a broad category. You know, people are called, you know, they're called Yasser Arafat.
Let's say Hamas.
Okay, Hamas's position officially is that they will accept a two-state solution based on 1967 borders. And in that respect, neither, you know, Fatah or Hamas disagree, that they want a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem and, you know, a state comprising of a fifth of their original homeland based in the West Bank and Gaza. The difference between Hamas and Fatah is on tactics, because the Fatah party has given up the armed struggle in favor of an internationally backed, well, more or less an American-backed peace process, whereby they hope eventually enough pressure will be brought in Israel to withdraw from the occupied territory so they can have their own state there. And Hamas would say, look, historically, we know that whenever there's a peace process, that Israel actually accelerates settlement expansion, just like it's doing now. And as an occupied population, they have an absolute right to resist violently. And given that Israel only understands the language of force, that is their best option. That's, if you like, the Palestinian extremist point of view, that generally the international community are not serious about a two-state solution because they never, when push comes to shove, you know, Israel will go ahead building more settlements and the international community will do nothing except talk about peace.
And sorry for my ignorance here, but, I mean, it just seems to me, are they all fighting because they, who do they want to pay taxes to? Which
no,
government?
It's,
I mean,
it's a very, 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 very simple reason. They are being displaced, and they have been for the last, you know, more than 60 years, from their homes. Their houses are demolished to make room for Jewish settlements. The better ones are actually thrown out into the streets, and Jewish settlers just move in. Those who live in rural areas have their farmland confiscated, and gradually they're been displaced. Their land's been taken away from them, their houses have been taken away from them, even their water supply's been diverted away from the settlements, away from the Palestinian communities to the settlements. And, you know, if you look at historically, every other single colonial conflict such as this has involved a defensive, violent reaction. Now, Israel chooses to call that terrorism, but if that's the case, then people like Chief Sitting Bull and Nelson Mandela were also terrorists.
Of course.
Yeah.
Looking back to the current situation, there's been a report that the Turkish Navy is going to escort the Gaza flotilla. This could really potentially end up in a war. What do you think the chances of that actually occurring are?
I haven't heard that rumor, and I doubt it. I don't think Turkey would be willing to push it that far.
Right. It's reported in the Mail Online from today. Yeah, Turkish Navy to back next convoy, but it's not the wording isn't really very clear.
Yeah,
it's more of a suggestion.
Actually, take a warship into Gaza's territorial waters.
It's unlikely,
see.
Isn't it?
We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it would then really be a question of nation-state versus nation-state then. It really, you know...
It would be a real international crisis.
Yeah.
I
mean, on some level, you know, it sounds good, but on the other side, it could just provoke such horrific bloodshed that you don't really want that to happen either.
Well, I mean, we're going to find out in a week or so because there's another ship that is preparing to enter Gaza's waters to bring supplies. And the activists, including parliamentarians from several countries, are determined not to be intimidated.
Yeah, this is a much more determined attempt than the previous one, which was just one ship, I think, wasn't it? The one that...
We've had... a few convoys before.
Right, okay.
The thing that's different about this one is it's a lot bigger.
Yeah.
The first time we started this at the end of 2006, the attempt to break the siege of Gaza. The first time it was successfully done was in August 2008 with a couple of wooden fishing boats.
Right.
And, you know, success breeds success. We've expanded our capacity. More people have joined. People have donated millions of dollars towards this now, which we couldn't have imagined before. When we raised our first $70,000 to buy a couple of boats, get the deposit on a couple of wooden fishing boats, we thought we were fantastic.
Mm.
But, you know, as Israel, especially after its assault on Gaza last year, a lot more people have wanted to do something substantial to really challenge a blockade. So, we've been successful and, you know, gradually snowballing and building up our capacity. But two, the situation in Gaza today is indescribable. You know, it's very difficult for people living in Australia to imagine how desperate the situation for ordinary people is in the Gaza Strip right now.
I think those
two things together have... given rise to such a huge blockade, a huge flotilla.
Mm. I honestly, when I see the images, I just think, how do people even have any food? How do they do anything?
Well, the economy
I think that of Iraq, let alone...
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially the economy's collapse. You know, according to many reports, the only source of economic activity is that associated with the aid agencies, like the United Nations, and smuggling goods in from Egypt. So, you know, some goods do get in from the UN, and others are smuggled in via tunnels from Egypt, which is, you know, Gaza's primary lifeline.
Mm. And what can people do from our shores to help the Gazan people?
Well, there's a lot of different Palestinian solidarity groups around Australia that you can join. All of them have email lists that keep people up to date with what's going on. And I would strongly recommend that you do so, because the most important thing you can do to make a difference is at least know what's going on in the world. If you drop an email to info@australiansforpalestine.com, my colleague, Ma'ama Mashni, he can put you in touch with the relevant Palestine solidarity group in your city. The other very important thing you can do is go to www.freegaza.org and check out, you know, this campaign's website. And if you feel so inclined, if you could go and make a donation, that's something substantive you could do. I think the most important thing you could do at this particular crisis in election year, and I know it sounds really banal and trivial, is to write to your local member, because people assume that politicians understand what, you know, they're there after, or the game is fixed. But it looks like it's going to be a fairly close election, and if your local member gets 5 letters on what's going on, then he'll be very concerned. And if you complain about the government's policy and the coalition's lack of policy regarding Gaza, then he'll take that straight to Stephen Smith and he'll say, look, I'm about to lose my seat here because of you. You need to harden up your position.
Yeah. You know, I think to some extent, Michael, the average person is so bombarded with fear of countries like Iran, and we're constantly told what a terrible threat to world peace Iran is, and it's a bit of a mind kind of a double think process going on when you've got supposedly we're a great ally of Israel, you know, and America is a great ally of Israel. And we see this country, Israel, behaving in a way which is so much worse than anything that you could see happening in Iran. And yet all we ever hear, you know, it's this problem we have is largely in the mind, because it's very hard, if you just take in the news that's given to you, to get a clear picture. I mean, at the moment, this is in the news for a few more days, but then it always drops off again until
exactly.
The next crisis.
Yes.
And then meanwhile, we get all the other propaganda coming back over and over again, drumming into us.
Yeah.
And I believe one of the most important things we need is free media, alternative media, like what we're doing here tonight. It's about waking you up and to find the information that exists, to talk about it, to share it, to basically respect that as well, you know, to understand that we actually have to be free to see the world as it truly is, and not just be fed the information from the, you know, the ministries of truth.
Yes, good point. It's like, I think that's the significance of what happened this week. Generally, people don't even think about what's happening in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, the news that they're fed about Israel is generally quite dumbed down. But every now and then, something shocking like this happens that kind of like breaks through that bubble. And then Israel goes into damage control and tries to, you know, sew back, you know, its webs of deceit and all that. But right now, people actually understand what's going on. They've had a glimpse of it. Unfortunately, you know, and I think this is really important, they're only seeing what's happened regarding the boats. They don't actually know how awful things are in the Gaza Strip. And when this story is no longer in the news, you know, kids will still be dying of diarrhea because 90 to 95% of the drinking water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People will still not be able to feed their families. That's according to Amnesty International. You know, the, all of the surface water sources, as I said, have been diverted away. So they're drinking, you know, seawater contaminated with sewage water. And that's the simple reason is, as I said, you know, that the surface waters have been diverted away from Israel, right. And Israel will not allow the spare parts and electricity in to renovate the sewage infrastructure that was destroyed during its assault on Gaza.
That's just horrendous.
It's shocking. It's hard when you actually read. If your readers want to just read a very simple short report, there's a very good one that came out at the end of last year by Amnesty International, and it's called "Thirsting for Justice." And it's if you type "Amnesty Thirsting for Justice" into Google, you'll find it. And it's more or less about just the water situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. And it's you read it and you just, I remember reading it and I just thought, I can't believe I'm living in a world where this kind of thing's happening and nobody seems to be doing anything about it or even talking about it or anything like that. And that's the point I'd make. It's like, yes, this atrocity on the high seas is really bad, but the real story is a hidden structural day-to-day violence that we very, very rarely see.
Yeah, and that needs to be continually highlighted. We played some excerpts from the film The Children of Gaza on the show a while back, which was a great, highly recommend that to anyone. There was a little documentary that was made fairly recently showing what life is like, and it was just heartbreaking, really, to see the sadness in those kids in that film. I guess you saw that one,
No,
Michael.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's a great little documentary,
the kind of thing
that
you
one.
Mean, yeah.
It's just to see the sadness in the children and kind of like they're wise before their time. You know,
yeah.
they have this intensity about them. They're very articulate. The film mainly talks to children and you know, they're very young, but they've got very articulate understanding of what's going on, and it's just it's just hard. But they haven't been allowed to be children. You know, they've just been forced to grow up very, very quickly.
Yeah, and I think you know, in terms of being activists around this issue, I think it's really important for people not to be out there burning flags and yelling and screaming, because it just makes everyone look fanatical. I think what needs to happen is thousands of people in numbers need to come out and have peaceful and vigil.
Yeah.
And constantly, all the time, and contact your representatives, like Michael said, constantly, all the time. Be a nagging citizen, because it is children and it is suffering and it is for no reason other than political gain. And I mean, you know, one thing that I would say as well is how you know, I know that people, the day-to-day Aussie, you'd say, oh, you know, give some money to the to some Palestinian organization. People would say, because they've been drilled so heavily about the terrorist activity, they'd say, well, I'm not going to do that because I'll be supporting some sort of terrorist organization. How do you respond to that, and how do we get around that?
Well, I mean, if you were supporting a terrorist organization, that, you know, that organization would very quickly be proscribed in Australia and its you know, members thrown in jail. Any Palestinian charity functioning in Australia today has to be, for want of a better word, extremely kosher.
Right, yeah.
You know, so that is not a genuine fear. And, you know, nobody's ever suggested that Free Gaza are a group of terrorists, but, you know, people are literally, and they risk their lives this week, they'll be risking their lives next week again, because they believe that they have a duty to, when, you know, the governments of the world do nothing, to stand up for what is right and to stand up for the oppressed people of Gaza. So
it is so
important.
If
you can't go with them, then if you could just kind of like go to www.freegaza.org and donate a few dollars, that would be an effective way of doing your little bit.
Excellent. I think it's important to point out that four Australian journalists were detained along with the peace activists, and as far as I know, they still haven't been released. Is that correct, Michael?
Latest I heard is that we're still waiting to for them to be released. And
I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, they're journalists.
It will be good to hear their side of the story. Like I said, we've only heard. It's very effective media management to lock up and deprive of any contact with the outside world one side of the this incident, and just have Mark Riggers and the Israeli government spokesperson saying, no, this is what really happened. They were attacking us.
Oh, it's
you know, that's, I mean, how long is it? It happened on Monday. It's now Wednesday night, and still they're denying us access to the people who are actually there, apart from the Israeli commandos who shot them.
Well, they're treating the press, they're treating our press. Paul McGough, the top Middle East correspondent from Fairfax, has been detained as if he were an enemy combatant. As far as I can see, he hasn't been allowed to write an article. He's part of the press.
I refuse to call it detainment. This is kidnapping.
Well, it's it's
because
totally.
They weren't in Israeli waters when this happened. They were in international waters. They were abducted on the high seas.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, there's no excuse for this. They were of
piracy,
no conceivable threat to Israel.
Great.
And, you know, well, I'm in one way, I'm not glad anyone died, but I'm glad that this has happened because, it doesn't focus directly on the Gazan people, but it's highlighting the situation of the bully tactics used by the Israeli government.
Yes, it is kind of, that's the idea behind the flotilla in the first place. When we were talking about what we could do, we said, you know, if Israel, excuse me, just one sec.
Folks, you're listening to truthnews.com.au. If you've got any questions.
Sorry, that was my mobile.
Please leave a comment on the truthnews.com.au. Sorry, back to you, Michael.
Like I said, when we were planning this operation, you know, we thought this was the best way to go about it because it puts Israel in a difficult situation. If they let the boat through, then we've broken their blockade, and that puts them in a difficult situation. But if they react as they've done this week, then that exposes the structural violence that has been hidden from the rest of the world, because the rest of the world doesn't even think about Gaza unless a rocket comes out of it or something like that. And that's the power of nonviolent direct action, essentially. We are nonviolent, and we force the other side either to back down or really bare their fangs in front of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this time they bared their fangs. We'd rather have got the cargo through. But essentially, you know, if you restrain yourself and, you know, you act in a disciplined way, then, it has had some positive effects. Even Hillary Clinton now is saying that the blockade is unsustainable. And if, you know, some good comes out of this, well, at least those people wouldn't have died in vain.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, look, we'll probably have to end it there, Michael, unless there's any final words you want to say.
No, thanks very much for the interview. And again, if your listeners feel like they want to do something, I'd recommend that they either contact their MP or they go to www.freegaza.org and make a donation.
Very, great. Very good. Very important, folks. And also, if you've got any questions, please comment on truthnews.com.au.
Yeah, and please get in touch with the groups here that we're talking tonight directly, and do whatever you can. Thanks very much, Michael, for coming on. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, that just about wraps it up for tonight. It's been
an amazing interview, folks. Folks, please grab that section of the interview, because we're so flat out. Grab it, stick it on YouTube. You know, do these little things that will spread the news for these poor people, because, you know, whether you're Jewish or not, we all want some sort of peace. You know, we all want to do our little bit. So
we do. We all want to do it. We do what we can.
it's these kids that are starving and dying and of ridiculous diseases. Like, I mean, it's just obscene that we're letting this sort of thing happen in the world when there's so much wealth and prosperity.
And it's always possible to do more. Just, you know, don't think you've got to go all the way. Don't set yourself an impossible goal. Just do a little bit more than what you've done so far. That's all we try to do. You know what I mean? Yes. We just try to do that little bit extra.
Yeah, go to freegaza.org and donate a couple of bucks, you know, 10 bucks. It's nothing, you know. It's a couple of beers, 20 bucks, 100 bucks if you can afford it. And also, like I said, try to get this on YouTube. It's really easy. Just grab the audio, cut the first half of the show and chuck this interview up there.
Yeah, well, that would be great if you could do that. We would love that. Thank you so much in advance.
Till next week.
Till next week.
Also, subscribe to the Twitter feed, twitter.com/truthnewsozoz.
And get us on Facebook, because we're on Facebook.
Okay. Get us everywhere. just syndicate it like crazy.
We are global. We are everywhere. Good night.
All right, till next week. Peace.
Cheers.